on this computer, so that you're aware I'm recording now. So if you say anything strange, it will be preserved for eternity, which includes me. Okay. So, well, I'm recording. So maybe that's a good point. So the first thing is, I'm offering this in an online manner, in a synchronized manner. So at the regular times, at Tuesday, Thursday is 10:30. But I also will record it. So if for some reason you drop out or you can't make it, you can look at it online. Obviously, you can ask questions, but you can always send email directly to me or talk with me in any way. We can schedule an individual meeting if you have questions or some questions about the content or the administrative stuff. Okay. So the plan I have sent you already, just to explain that very quickly. We have a plan for this lecture, which says, okay, what you're gonna do, what's the content, what's our textbook, and so on and so forth. And I had to adjust this for online lectures. And I thought this is a very, very good course to do it, because we have mainly theoretical stuff. So it's algorithms, you have a good textbook, which is there, you have my lecture notes online, and I can complement it, I will complement it with a couple of videos, and then we have online sessions. That was the main idea. It should be not too hard to adjust that. Well, this class here has mainly master and PhD, or only master and PhD students, so I think you're already say a bit more advanced in that sense, and that should be easier to do it with you. So that's one thing, and Albert has mentioned already, so we had a review from the CompPG, also our commission for the postgraduate studies program, and there was a go, there were a few comments, a longer comment from the students, which mainly said, okay, they are a bit concerned about the interactivity. We will see how that works. I mean, these online sessions are meant to be interactive, so I'm constantly watching the chat over here. If you have any questions, feel free just to put it in there or ask directly, and we can discuss the material. But my basic approach here would be a kind of a flipped learning, right? So I have already sent you a couple of shorter videos, which are explaining breadth first search, random search, and depth first search. And the idea is that you basically have a look at the material. You may read the chapters of the book. You may look the videos. You can look at any other videos if you want, if you like to. And then we have time to review this and to discuss questions and to see more examples in these online sessions. So maybe as a consequence, these online sessions will be a bit shorter than the regular lecture. We will see. I'm willing to do it full time. So we have 100 minutes, 10:30 to 12:10, as always. But maybe if the material is clear and there are fewer questions, maybe we can get over that a bit shorter. Also, I will try to make in these online lectures a couple of new points or extra examples, and we will see how that works today. Well, that's that. Is any question to the overall admin staff, what we're going to do? Chat silent, and no questions here. Okay. Microphones are silent. Okay. Okay. Just yeah, maybe. Well, that's mostly what I wanted to say. We have for formal attendance, because now we have formal online lectures. What's the difference from my point of view? It's mainly that it counts as a formal attendance. So if you're part of this lecture, you attended the lecture already, and you don't have to do it again. It's just you formally were part of this because it requires it. Very probably we will have to offer face-to-face sessions later anyway, and in this case you can, but you don't need to see the face-to-face. lessons later. So Bruno is asking, what about questionnaires, evaluation exams, same chronogram? Yes. So these questionnaires or quizzes, as I call it, I hope that's what you mean with questionnaires. So the quizzes is just for formal attendance. I will later try to do that, but there will also be an offline version. So there will be a quiz and a simple or multiple choice quiz, but you say, okay, this and that, yes or no, it can be this, it can be that, and you send me the quiz. I won't do very much with that quiz, except maybe some statistics and answer questions to the quiz, but it's not part of the evaluation. You don't get grades for that. The quiz is just substituting your presence. So I'm just, so you get the formal presence here. Well, I see you now, you're here, take a photo or we record this session anyway. But if you want to do it offline, you can do it also, send me the quiz and you're there. So that's not a very strict requirement for presence. But anyway, if you my point of view, if you come to the lecture and you're thinking of other things, I can't control that and I don't want to do it. So if you don't, for some reason, turn off the camera and the audio and send me the quiz later, I don't want to know about it and don't want to control it. So it's just... That should not be an obstacle. The next thing, evaluation, etc., the same chronogram. Yes, the evaluation, that's also simple in this lecture, I think. We have in the algorithm part four exercise lists, and they will always take home. So after finishing the block on graphs, I will publish online an exercise list, and there will be a due date of about 10 days, 2 weeks to do that, and you turn it in. And I will grade them as I always did. So that will be rather simple. And maybe Alvaro can comment on his part, but I think lots of evaluations in that part are the same. Now we have also a if you fail to make the passing grade, we also have an exam which traditionally was together with the qualification exam. So the qualification exam has to be in a presential mode, and that is pushed back when we know how the semester will go. We will offer the qualification exam. Obviously, there will also be rules I expect from the postgraduate program, how this will be done. In terms of the total time you can do the qualification exam, and then you can do together with that qualification exam your second exam if you fail to make the grade, but everything else will be the same. So about the chronogram, let me see that if I can share my my desktop here very quickly. So you should see the homepage. Of the course, algorithm theory of computation, as always. So I put here in Portuguese, unfortunately, so the chronogram for so the agenda for the online lectures. And I made a very rough plan. That is the plan for, okay, today we have graph algorithms one, and then on Thursday we'll have the second one, next Tuesday. So if everything goes well, I'm going over in the regular rhythm. Let's say I will go over the algorithm part, and then probably Alvaro will take over. I'm also aware that. Okay, someone. Sorry, I didn't hear that. Eduardo, it's a question.
Hi. Hi. It's Eduardo.
Hi, Eduardo. Do you want to ask a question?
No. I was just late.
Okay, no problem. Maybe you turn off the microphone, and you can also use the chat if you want to ask a question. You can turn on your microphone at any time if you want to ask a question, but it's maybe just to reduce the ambiental noise for everybody. Okay, thanks. Talking about the plan, so you will find the plan here, and we will see how that goes. I'm aware that we're doing this for the first time. It's the very first online lecture I'm giving in that mode. Things can fail, things maybe not work, maybe you're not satisfied with what we're doing, and so on and so forth. So I'm willing to adjust this as is needed. Give me feedback, tell me what it is. if it's too hard, too complicated, too different, too new for you, we can make it only every Tuesday, for example. So we go in a slow rhythm. But at the moment, the plan is just to go ahead with this. I will keep this agenda here updated and adjusted as we will need it. Okay. Okay. Boom. Did I answer your questions? Anybody else? Maybe. It's okay. Yeah. So just let me say also, I had prepared this lecture, so I'm aware things can fail, and that should not be a problem. I'm recording this. You can do it offline. You can just do not hesitate enter in contact with me by any means and tell me what's working, what's not working. I have to adjust to this too. It's new for me too. So we're trying to make the best out of it. Learn some algorithms and have fun as good as it gets. I have been preparing this lecture this morning completely. Everything here, my browser window, everything, iPad, and so on. And then my PC just turned off. Boom, and had to reboot it 5 minutes before the session. So that can happen anytime, and it can happen with you. And so if I'm falling out of the session for some weird reason, just hang on a little bit. Maybe I have to reboot my PC. Did not happen in the last 3 weeks. Happened today, right before the lecture. So yeah, we are a bit dependent on technical stuff. Okay. Yeah, Bruno says yes. So that's working. So fine. That's more or less what I wanted to say about administrative stuff. I don't know, Albo, do you want to add something?
Hi everyone. I'm Max. Where put your views in your homepage?
Excuse me.
The videos that you are you're gonna record, you're gonna make them available in your homepage.
Yes. Yes. I send you the videos in the emails via the portal, the UX, what's it called, Gateway Students, student system. I have to put it on the page. I have a tiny technical difficulty doing it remotely because I cannot log in into my Wiki, but I will solve that problem. So yes, for the individual lectures, okay, just let me start. Let me share my screen again here. So we have here Graph Algorithms 1. What I want to do is I will create a page for Graph Algorithms 1, and then there will be a link instead of this text only. And you can click on this one, and there will be the videos, and there will be the quiz and other material that may appear. You will see later. I have some code and some implementation, some visualizations to show you. And that will go on for every lecture. So when I'm preparing the lecture, so for Thursday, we will possibly talk about topological ordering, acyclic graphs, bipartiteness, and so on and so forth. I will send you an email with the lectures, and I put them here on Graph Algorithms 2 already. Then you can have a look at it, and later there will appear the quiz and maybe additional material. Are there any sample exam questions in English? I found something in Portuguese. Good question. Yes, I think there should be, but I'm not completely sure. Everything I have, so we're on the homepage. If you go to 2019.1, that was the last one I did. So there's the post-semester exam, for example. Let's have a look at that. Okay. Oh, and that's in Portuguese. Okay, yeah, I see your point. I have to. Okay, you can obviously have a try. I think we did exams. Post semester exam was happening here. We did exams in English, but yeah, most of them, whenever there were no students with English. Well, that's not a problem. If you want, I can do two things. I can look up what exams are available in English, and I can send them to you. And I can, if you want, just translate it. But maybe you can just pass it over DeepL or some translator. Solved problems and exercise in the book are enough? Yes. The solved exercise and problems in the book are very, very, very good. They are well made, they're creative, they're interesting. So if you are able to solve the problems in the book, you certainly will pass the exam. Okay. So that's Fraser and Mateus. Pre-semester exam, why are you concluded this essays quarto completo pre-semester exam? Oh, the pre-semester exam. No, the pre-semester exam, here, postponed pre-semester exam. There will be no exam as of now, because the pre-semester exam is for the CMP 600 guys, basically, which have to do the qualification exam for their PhD. And we have always one exam at the beginning of semester and another at the end of the semester. But that's very difficult to do it online or take home. That would be completely different. So we just push that, it's postponed. We don't know the date. So when, say, assume in May, we get back to regular face-to-face classes, then we will have the new plan for the whole semester, which probably will extend into the second semester, into September, October, and then we will define, so the PPC, the postgraduate program, will define new dates for the pre-semester exam and the post-semester exam, and we will do them then. And one of these exams will also serve as a recovery exam for the next, but this will be online. So in a presential way, okay? Good. Yeah, more questions? Mateus, it's okay. No, I think fine. Alvaro, okay from your part?
No, for me it's fine, so I see you all in May. According to the calendar, my part starts on 21st of May. So yeah. See you there.
Okay.
Bye everyone.
Okay, bye Alvaro. So
ciao.
So okay. Yeah, let's see. Now I'm gonna stop sharing again. So the plan for today is, and I'm going to share another screen here. So let's do this like this. Okay. So now you should see another screen. And the plan for today was, we already talked about breadth-first search and random search in the third lecture, I think. And I wanted to review this. Because, yeah, well, it was some 3 weeks ago, something like that. I have these two videos. And then I want to go into depth first search and questions about implementations. So what we are here in the book, I'm showing you here the book of Kleinberg-Tardos. Just seeing a message. So it's the third chapter. We have here, look at it maybe like this. We have a graph connectivity and graph traversal. We have implementing graph traversal. And maybe I make a quick comment about testing bipartiteness, but that will be reserved for the third lecture, basically. So graph connectivity and graph traversal then is here this chapter, which we are going to discuss today. So as a review, maybe, I'm not sure, were you able to see the videos? Did that work? Or read that part? More or less? Do you remember part of the breadth-first search? There's a yes. Oh, a couple of yeses. Okay. Okay, good. So you can give feedback for the videos and everything. I was able to watch them. Yes. You can give feedback anyway, if it's too boring, too long, too short, too green, too blue. Because I'm doing this in the first time, I know that there are several aspects that can be better with these videos. So they're kind of real life. I'm recording from home. To make that much better, I would have to invest more time. I will have this time for further lectures, but we'll see. But I think that they get over the same, the basic thing. So Just to review that and try going over that quickly, but you can stop me at any point. So we are exploring an undirected graph. That's our context at the moment. We will see directed graphs later. And so we have this undirected graph, and we have just a set of vertices here, right? And usually I use n for the number of vertices, and we have a couple of edges, a set of edges here, and I usually, as always, it's a broad convention, I use m for the couple of the number of edges we have in this graph. And we want to explore this graph, and we have been looking already at the breadth first search. So it's working. I've written it down a little bit different, but it's working basically like this. You have you start from some starting vertex here. So it's S, it's starting vertex from the set of vertices, can be any one of these of the vertices, and you start with a level set L0. And then, I forgot here to set I equals zero also. And then while the current level set Li is not empty, you produce the level set Li plus one, so the next level set. And for doing this, you take all these vertices, which are connected to a vertex U in the current level set Li and have not been seen already. And you and obviously are connected by an edge. And when doing this, go back a little bit, you get the next level set here. I've also added, I haven't shown this in the video, I've added also explicit generation of the tree. So the tree edges are at the empty set at the beginning, and then down here you just add the edges here in every step. You can see that the condition is exactly the same, while in the first, in the upper part here, you are just selecting the vertices which were not seen. Here you put the edges into the set, two vertices which were not seen. This gives you the tree, and then you just go to the next level, to the next iteration, and continue until the level set gets empty, and then the breadth first search stops. Okay with that? Any questions about the basic idea of that algorithm? Okay, don't see anything at the moment. Okay, so then a couple of observations on that. So we have observed it already, just to remember. So we have first that Li contains the nodes at distance I. From the starting node S. So L0, obviously, all the nodes are distance zero, is S only. Then L1 contains those nodes or vertices which are distance one, L2, distance two, and so on. And we have a path from S to T if T isn't some Li. What I didn't put there, so BFS S actually, like this, BFS S, explores then the connected component of S. So if you have a graph which is not connected, something like that, okay, and there's another part, and here's our S, we will explore obviously only this part here. And this comes from that characteristic down here. An ST path exists if T is in Li for some I. So that would be what you see here. And we already observed BFS defines a BFS tree, T. So the construction of the tree is explicitly over there. And we had this proposition that if there are two vertices in the tree, and they are in different layers, then the difference of the layers is at most one. So in the BFS tree, there can be no edge between vertices which has a difference in layers more than one. Okay with that. Makes sense. Yeah, we have been seeing this, I think, live and in the video. Okay. We see then to the next thing, to the next point. So this is be what we have been discussing, breadth-first search. It's now this here. Now what I call random search is, let me see it here, right? Exploring a connected component in the book of Kleinberg-Tarlosch. So random search is also very simple. Random search starting from a vertex S in V, anyone just collects all the vertices in a set R. Initially, this is only contains only S. And then you just have a look. If there is a vertex U in the set of already seen vertices, and there is another which has not been seen already, and there is an edge, or that should be really edge here, and there is an edge between these two vertices, then you add the unseen vertex to the set R, which we explore. And you do this until there is no unseen vertex anymore. And in the same manner as BFS, then this will explore the connected component. So R at the end of that is exactly the connected component of S. So that's the most simple search you probably could do. You start from any vertex. You don't care about the order. Just look if there is some vertex connected. So you maybe are going here in the graph. You start with the vertex S, and it is adjacent to a couple of vertices, and you just take one of them. Well, let's maybe do it like this. Okay, S initially has been done. You take just one of them, this guy maybe, okay? And then you look, okay, this guy is connected to more vertices. So all these vertices which are not colored at the moment are candidates. And our set R would be this one here at the moment, right? And you could take any one of them, maybe this guy here over there, and say, okay, let's put it into the set R. And this guy may have other neighbors over there, and all these white vertices are candidates and so on. And you're not obliged to move on here on the right side. I could go here back to that left side and increase the set R in this manner here. And this guy may have other neighbors and so on. Right? That's why I call it random search, because this exists here. Yeah. While there exists a new vertex which was not explored yet, you take it and put it into there. But this exists hides a choice. There can be many vertices, and it doesn't say which one you're choosing. You can randomly choose anyone. So that makes an exploration without any definite order. And then you get also the connected component of S. So it would work in the same manner as breadth-first search would work, just without any definite order. Does it make sense? Okay, any questions on that at the moment? No questions? The search is always random, Marcus's question. Not necessarily. Actually, it depends on how you would implement it, right? Because what to see this again, this existence here, while there exists some, hides a choice. If you can implement, so implementation, what's that? You can implement this in many different ways. You can implement it in a non-random manner. So of all the vertices which have not been visited yet, and are connected somehow to a vertex which has been visited already, you could choose one randomly, and then it's a random search. But you could also say, okay, I always choose the vertex of the smallest index in some order. And then it's not random, it just always does the same thing. So you can implement it in a random manner, but you can implement it in a different way also. I will show you that later with a code, how I did it, but it depends on how you do it, how you find it. This hides a loop, basically, if you think about that. That would not be the most efficient manner, but it hides a loop. Go over all the vertices in R, check all the neighbors, and check for each neighbor if that neighbor is not visited. And so you get all the unvisited neighbors of the current set R, and then choose one of them. And how you do that choice, that could be the first one, it could be the last one, it could be the one of the smallest index, it could be a random one, that's your choice. Make sense? Okay. Well, okay, that's random search. And now, if there are no questions, you can, okay, just bring it on if there are more questions, something else. That first search, I sent you the video too. Could you please give an example of a random search in a real world? Oh, that's a good question. A random search in a real world. The best thing, ooh, that's a good question. I'm not really sure. I mean, if you would ask me if I could give an example of a breath first search or something like that in a real world, maybe I would have difficulties to come up with that again. What would I model as a random search? The best thing I can come up with right now would be some kind of, it's a little bit artificial maybe, but okay, let's try it anyway. Okay, if you think about, maybe it's partly, if you think about crystal formation or something like that, let's put it over there. If you think about crystal formation, for example, how does that work? Usually you have a seed, so a crystal, that would be a chemical, right? A stone or something, whatever, diamond, maybe not. But you have a seed, a particle, something like that. And then there are other particles floating around in the environment. And at some point, some particle just connects to the existing particle. And by the chemical structure of it, you get a regular lattice or something like that, right? And there are other particles flowing around, they are diffusing, they make a Brownian motion, right? A random walk, and there's a particle and it connects here. And there's another particle that connects over there, and there's another particle that connects over there, and so on and so forth. That would be, in some sense, a kind of a random search, if you want, because the diffusion of the particles in the environment follows a random Brownian motion, and you can predict what would be the next one which connects. But the underlying structure of the crystal is given by chemical properties. So if such a floating particle connects, it has to connect in a kind of a regular lattice structure, say, to make it simple. So if I go over that again here on the left side, I could model a regular lattice by a regular graph, right, like this. Okay. With a regular connectivity pattern like this. Okay, and now if I say, okay, this is my seed vertex, I do a random search. And now at the moment, only the orange seed particle exists. The rest of the lattice does not exist. And so there are particles conceptually floating around here, and they connect, but they have to connect. So floating around and connects over here. So they have to connect in a regular lattice structure. That would be that one. But now the next one goes maybe over here, and the next one goes maybe over here, and the next one goes over here, or goes over here, and there, and here, and there, and so on. You don't know that. That could be maybe the best one. I could come up at the moment. Conceptually, algorithmically, it's just another way to do what you to explore the connected component. This is equivalent in some sense to the other two, graph first search, depth first search. Okay. There is Luciana. I think it is based for other algorithms variations, right? Maybe if I get that right, I think it's yeah, it can be used as a base for other variations of the algorithms. So in some sense, the random search includes the breadth first search and the depth first search. It's the most general one. You can emulate, if you want, by making a specific implementation here. You can turn a random search into a breadth first search, but taking it in order of distances. Or you can make a random search into a depth first search just by taking it in an last in, first out order. Is that responding to your question? Okay. The next one then is a DFS. I've been discussing this in the video. So here's the complete recursive implementation of a DFS. You're calling it again here on a starting vertex. We could be anyone from the set of vertices. You set this vertex as visited, and then you go over all the neighbors here of the current vertex. And those one which were not visited yet, you call DFS recursively. And also at that point, you add the edge from U to V. So at that point, V was visited, it's already visited. U is unvisited, so you get a tree edge from V to U, an undirected tree edge in this case from V to U. So you keep building the, in this case, a T would be a global variable, right? Shared among all these recursive calls. We will later see a non-recursive implementation, and then we can maintain the variable T. Simply in this simple case, it's just a global variable. The observations we can make here is it defines again tree. So the DFS gives you a search tree. In this search tree, well, it's a little bit inconsistent because here I put an undirected edge. So that would be an undirected edge. This gives you an undirected tree. I could also put here just, let me do this, into the set, a directed edge that goes from U to V, right? And then I get a directed tree over here. So you can make this tree, if you want, undirected or directed. And what I'm talking about down here is every vertex except S, which is a starting vertex, has exactly one incoming arc. Here I'm talking about this directed version. And then the tree would be something like starting from S, you visit some other vertices here, and in turn, recursively, you visit some other vertices. So that would be a traversal of that. So this is the directed search tree of BFS. And we have seen and discussed that all the explored vertices during DFSS, so here, right, DFSS, are descendants of S. So these guys, we mark them, these guys are all descendants of S, which is the starting vertex in that search. Okay. And we have also seen that this proposition that, so down here, so if, oh, again, that should be E. So if XY is an edge and it's not in the tree, then either X is an ancestor of Y, so it goes down there later in the search tree is Y, or Y is an ancestor of X. There is no other way that could happen. In particular, that's important if you imagine a search tree like that, very quickly again, it's like this and like that. Such a non-tree edge could not be here, right? It could not be that this one is X and this one is Y. Because in this search tree, neither X is the ancestor of Y, nor Y is the ancestor of X. That cannot happen because if you see, our argument was, if you see X first, so take this first, then during a recursive call visiting X, you will visit Y. So there must be some direct arc or edge, or it must be a descendant. And that holds also if you visit Y first. So in this case, you cannot have this. We will later see that's also important to contrast it later. We will later see that if you search in direct graphs, that's not the case. Okay. So this characteristic of a DFS only holds for undirected graphs. Okay with that. Does it make sense? One is the incest of the other. Descendants. Three. Okay. Makes sense. Okay. Good. So let's move on. I wrote down a question here. Why don't we just visit every vertex in an arbitrary order? I mean, you have the list of all vertices. So if you want to explore a graph, just make a for loop over all the vertices. Isn't that the same as exploring the graph? Maybe a strange question. Not really clear. Yeah, maybe, yes. Okay. It's a very. What would it mean to visit in an arbitrary order, right? You have a graph like this, okay, and it's some connectivity pattern, whatever. Okay, something like that, maybe. And then it's possible to reverse in opposite direction. Everything okay here? Okay. What I'm suggesting is you take some arbitrary order and look at every vertex. So you look at this one, 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 look at this one. You ignore connectivity, just go over the vertices. But the problem is, and maybe that's a strange question. What we want to explore are connected components, right? Components. Component by component. This will be interesting later. So if you just jump over the vertices in some random way, let me do this again, from here to there to there to here to here to there, you have nothing like that. In particular, if the graph is not connected, so we have another connected component over here, maybe you may visit just a couple. So let me roll this back, maybe like this. Okay. So put that component over here. Okay, if you visit that in an arbitrary order, you get maybe a vertex from this component, then from that, then again from this, then again from that, from here, from there, and over there, and things like that. So that's not exploring the graph or the components. That's just jumping around the vertices. Right? So you have to take into account adjacency in some sense to explore connected component. That's basically what we want to do. So the focus is on connected components. Okay, looking at the chat. Yeah, everything okay? Yes, it is possible to reverse in the opposite direction, says Abel. Yes, I don't know if it's a question or a remark. Opposite direction in a strong sense is not there because we are still in undirected graphs, right? So you just start exploring at some of the vertices here, and since the edges are undirected, you can go into any direction. Go there, go there, go there, and so on. How can you define complexity? Can you define anything without an implementation? Oh, very good question, Bruno. How can we define complexity? Can we define anything without an implementation? Yes and no. not really, We will come to that. So you see down there is a film representing graphs. I have to, we have been saying at the very beginning, so let me roll back to the BFS maybe, okay. We need to make that concrete, we can say, okay, how many iterations will I make here, for example, right? So the analysis of the BFS in this case would be, okay, how many iterations do I take in this while loop, for example, and then what does it cost to produce the next level set? We can ignore the trees for the moment because I don't necessarily create the trees. And what does it cost to create the initial set? So you need specify data structures. How do we represent these sets L, L0, L1, L2, and so on? And then what does it cost to do that? Also, what you're going to do here is you take, for example, here a vertex from the ith level set, and you want all the edges. That should be, by the way, also edges here. We want all the edges. So this depends also on a data structure for the graph. So to make that concrete, you would have to say, what does it cost to visit an edge? And what does it cost to maintain these level sets? So the answer is a partial yes. If you remember at the beginning, we can make an analysis of this algorithm in terms of the operations of the data structures. So for example, go over all the neighbors. Yeah, you have to visit all the neighbors of each vertex once. So we could define a couple of operations. Take a set, insert an element in the set, check element in the set, remove an element in the set. And we can make a couple of operations for graphs. I don't know, insert a vertex, remove a vertex, visit all the neighbors of a vertex, and then you can make a high-level analysis in terms of these operations. But to have a concrete complexity at the end, we have to define how we do want to implement the sets, how do we want to implement the graphs, and what is the cost of these operations, and then you get a concrete complexity. And we're going to do this right now. Is this okay answering your question? Bruno, yeah. Okay. Seems to. So, so the first step on that, okay, to make it concrete, how do we represent graphs? How do we do that? There are two basic representations. You may know, I may have seen graphs, they are actually so common, which is adjacency matrices or adjacency lists. So let's first look at these two matrices. Matrices, how does it work? So an adjacency matrix, that would be just a huge matrix, n times n for all the vertices. So remember, you have n vertices and times n, one of vertices. And now if you have, say, an edge from 3 to 2, an undirected edge, put the 3 here, over there, you just put in this matrix a 1 in these two points, right? So let's call this A. So if 3, 2 is in the set of edges, then you have that A 2 3 equals A 3 2 equals 1, right? And in this case, you will have a symmetric matrix. Similarly, say there's 7, something like that. Okay, if you have an edge from 3 to 7 in the set of edges, you would put another one from 3 to 7 and from 3 to 7, so A 3 7 equals A 7 3 equals 1. And the rest of the matrix, I don't put this here, let's put it in the corner here, the rest of the matrix is 0. An adjacency matrix is convenient for some operations and less convenient for others. For example, for testing, if an edge UV is in the edge set, it's very convenient. You just look if AUV equals 1. So this is a constant time operation, right? For looping over all the neighbors of a vertex, let's just take for loop, some unspecified body, what does it cost? N squared, n minus 1, yeah, n minus 1 something. Depends, if you do it plainly like this, you have only the matrix, nothing else, it would cost linear time. The loop would be something like that for all the i's from 1 to n. Let's call it for all the u's, okay, for all the u's from 1 to n, if a uv, then do something for the neighbors, right? You loop over all the possible candidate neighbors, and then you check if it's really a neighbor. So if that's true, then you execute something on that name. So that would be by the index range of the loop over here, that would be order of n. So if you do that naively, iterating all the neighbors is more costly. We're going to see that. Yeah. A test is a constant time, but looping over all the neighbors costs more than you have to have a number of the neighbors. Inserting edges, removing edges would be very, very simple. Just what we did over here, right? To insert an edge, set it equal to 1. To remove an edge, you would just set it here over to 0 again. That's very simple. Inserting and removing vertices would be a bit harder in this presentation too. But the main point here about adjacency matrices, and maybe I mentioned this already, is the memory consumption is theta n squared, right? Because the matrix has n times n cells over here. And so you have a storage which is proportional to n squared. And that's usually a huge problem because, as you can see on our matrix, I have a couple of ones here, and all the rest of this matrix is 0. So usually this matrix is sparse. To make that more explicit, let's look at a very simple graph again, maybe a 5-cycle, very simple, okay. So I have to construct all this huge matrix here, 5 by 5, with all the cells. And what I have is, let's do it 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have an edge from 1 to 2, from 2 to 3, from 3 to 4, and from 4 to 5, and the rest is 0. So this matrix is sparse over here. I have lots of zeros, and usually you don't want to represent it. And cycles of this kind have have order of n edges. So m equals order of n edges. So even if you have order of n, you have exactly n vertices, and you have order of n edges, or exactly n edges if you want, you need anyway order of n squared storage. And that's usually too much. You usually don't want to pay that. Okay, so adjacency matrix can be interesting if you have to frequently test for edges, but there are other ways out of that too. So what you usually do, is okay with the adjacency matrices, basic idea. Okay, so I have to delete this here to make up some space. What you usually do is you use adjacency lists, and that would be maybe in the simplest implementation, you take a list of vertices. Okay, let's call this V. Okay, And here is vertex 1, followed by vertex 2, followed by vertex 3, followed by, and so on and so forth. Can be a doubly linked list if you want. Followed by vertex n, and then maybe it wraps over. It's just a doubly linked list of vertices. So we can go over all these vertices here. And now every vertex has a list of adjacent vertices. So this is the main vertices, and now vertex one is adjacent. So these are the adjacency lists. Adjacent maybe to vertex 3, can be also doubly linked list. Adjacent to vertex 17, and maybe adjacent to vertex 23. Then you will find in the list of vertex 3, obviously the vertex 1, because it's an undirected graph, but vertex 3 may be also adjacent, I don't know, to vertex 16 and so on. So if you look at some vertex here and its degree, then the size of that list is exactly, so in this case, the length of that list is exactly the number of neighbors. So for every vertex, you need a list of the length of the number of neighbors. And so the total length of all these lists is the total degree. And I think we have been discussing this. This gives you 2m. So the total space you need here is order of n plus m. So it's a linear space. And that's a huge advantage of adjacency lists. And that's why we usually prefer adjacency lists over adjacency matrices. You can also see that iterating over all the neighbors in adjacency lists is very simple. You just go over the list, right? You iterate over the list and you get all the neighbors. And it costs, maybe I put this here in green, it would cost order of number of neighbors only. So it's even more efficient. However, testing for an edge, if you take only this implementation we have until now, that would cost more, right? You have, for testing for an edge, you have to go over the adjacency list of vertex, say U, and see if V is in that adjacency list. So that would be a bit more costly. On the other hand, inserting edges is similarly easy, right? To insert an edge, okay, maybe there's a new edge from V3 to V20, then you just put it in constant time at the end of this list here, for example. To remove it, you have to find the element first. So if you don't have a handle or a pointer to that element, you have to search for it. So that will cost order of delta V again to iterate over the list, and then you can remove it in constant time. Okay with that? I mean, our basic graph algorithms just, they are passive, they are read-only, right? We are just only iterating over neighbors, basically. So the operation of iterating over neighbors over here, that's the most important thing we have in this data structure. And that is, so the adjacency list is perfect for us because that costs only exactly the number of neighbors. And it also has linear space. So it's a small space and it's very efficient. A short comment on that, adjacency lists or vectors. Adjacency lists are called adjacency lists because you can do them with lists. But if you don't want to manipulate the graph, so you don't want to insert vertices or remove vertices, insert edges or remove edges, you can also store all that stuff in arrays, right? So maybe I put this, I'm running out of space here. let me put this over here. So if you think about that, it's just a very quick comment on the implementation. Okay, you get an adjacency list like this. Okay, a list there's a list of doubly linked list of vertices. Okay. And there's a doubly linked list on each vertex with the neighbors. You can compact this and just make an array of all the vertices, 1, 2, up to n. And this array stores a pointer to another array, which has the neighbors. So vertex 1 in our example, what was it? 3, 17, and 20. That's just another array of links. 3, which has 3, 17, and 20. And this example down here, vertex 3 has 1, 16, and 20. Okay, that would be like this. And there's a pointer to another array of 1, 16, and 20. So you can just compactify this. This would be an adjacency vector. And that's easy because you can navigate directly to a vertex and you can navigate directly to the first, second, or third neighbor without further ado. You implement it as a vector of vectors. So in C++, that would be literally a vector of ints. You call it A for adjacency. And that's it. You allocate this data structure once and then you just iterate over it. Okay. So you can compact this even more. Okay, with that part, adjacency lists. I think it's okay. Okay, if there are any questions, stop me here. Before we can implement the searches, I have to discuss very quickly. I think you know them. Two data structures. We have a queue, basically. So this one here is queue, which processes items in first in, first out order. We have usually two operations, which are called NQ or push and DQ or pop. Add an element at one end and remove an element at the other end. Right. So a queue is basically something like that. And you can push elements into that end and you can pop elements from the other end. And there are a couple of elements here. So if you make a push, it will grow on the left end, it pushes, and you make pops, then it will ungrow, so it will decrease here on the right end, okay. And the other data structure, which you probably all already know, two is a stack. That's just a last in, first out order. So you push things onto the stack and it grows at the top. And if you move elements with a pop, push and with pop operation, you would remove these elements from the top downwards again. Okay. Both of these data structures. Oh, well, I put it as a question. So how can we implement these data structures? Is it hard? What do the operations cost, push, pop, in these cases? It's difficult. Because we have been talking about the data structures for graphs, and we see that iterating over the neighbors, that's all of the number of neighbors, that's good. And now we need these guys still to implement our breadth first search and our depth first search. So it will matter what the operations cost. So what do you think? How to do it? Maybe you did implement it already. What? Oh, it's not cheap. Can you add remove at the same place? Yeah, indeed. The operations are cheap. I mean, the simplest way for doing a stack, and it's done like that in implementations. You can again take okay for a stack, you take a vector, right? And this vector has some elements, and it maybe grows at the end. So you have to know how many items you want to store. Maybe there's more storage here. And if you do a push, you just add another element at the end. And if you do a pop, you move an element at the end. So it's just you maintain a counter, a pointer here. So this is n number of elements. For example, you increase the counter to n plus 1 and put a new element here, or you decrease the counter to n if you remove it. Right? problem arises, says Mateus, when you need to find a specific element and remove it. Yes, that's these guys are not made for that. Yeah, if you have to search, I mean, a stack maintains the elements in the order you pushed it on the stack. So if you want to know if a certain element is in the stack, you don't know, you have to go over all the stack. And if the stack has a capacity for n elements, that will be order of n. That's the importance of defining what data structures and what operations on the data structures you need, right? If you want to make only pushes or pops, then using a vector for implementation of a stack is perfectly good. And you get a push and pop here in order of one, right? But if you want to make a search for an element, that would be order of n. So if you make frequent searches, you want to maybe use another data structure. A queue, how is that implemented? Usually in the same way. So you just take a vector, which has some, no, it's the same, has some capacity, maybe for at most n elements. That would be the case in our algorithms. And you start with two pointers, right? Okay, they point at the same position, which means the queue is empty. Whenever you add something to the queue, you take one of the pointers. Let's move the second guy. One of the pointers and advance it to the next position and put the element there. And you may possibly advance it again, put another element, advance it again, put another element. That would be pushes. And then if you make pops, you want to remove it at the other side. And then to make pops, then you remove that. Okay, let's remove these two guys and advance that pointer. So this element formally is not anymore part of the queue. If you want to make another pop, then you advance the second pointer again to the front, to this guy here, and this element formula is not part of the queue anymore. So it has a maximum capacity of n. You have to make sure that the pointers don't overtake themselves, but this can be also implemented in a simple vector, and you get also order of one for pushes and pops. So indeed, the operations are cheap. You do it in vectors and you know how many elements you want. If you don't know how many elements you want to put into these data structures, you can make intelligent reallocation strategy and you can still maintain pushes and pops in amortized time order of one. But that's not important for what we're doing because we know that the stacks and the queues we want to use have at most n elements. We are talking about vertices here in breadth first and depth first searches. Okay. So finally, coming to the implementation, it's very simple to implement a BFS and DFS, and I want to show you this in actual code. You can implement the BFS just maintaining vertices in a queue. So you explore the initial vertex S, and then you put all the unexplored vertices in the queue and explore it in that order. And the DFS in a non-recursive variant, it would be non-recursive, you're just using a stack, and it's exactly the same thing. And you know, maybe that's a general theorem say that any recursion can be eliminated by the use of a stack, and that's actually how your processor does it. And so we will be using a stack explicitly to eliminate the recursion in our recursive version of DFS, and then have it. And the beautiful thing about this is that actually the only thing that changes here is the change from a queue to a stack, and otherwise these two algorithms are exactly the same. We'll see this in a moment. How do we implement, before looking at this, a random search? And what does everything cost at the end of the day? Now, the random search is a bit more difficult to implement because we have to choose a new yet unexplored vertex, which is connected to our set R of vertices, which has been explored already. So this set R has, could call this kind of a fringe, right, of vertices. So these let's put this in orange here. These guys would be fringe vertices. unexplored vertices connected to some already explored vertex in R. And I can select one of these fringe vertices randomly. So to implement the random search efficiently without going over all the vertices and edges all the time, I will maintain also a queue or a stack or vector for that matter of fringe vertices. Can be anything because I'm going to choose a random one there. So I make a random access to a vector of fringe vertices, take one, select it, and put it into R, and maybe update my vector of fringe vertices. Okay. And now we can respond before looking at the implementations. We can respond the costs of the graph searches. So what would be a BFS cost with that? We can see that over all the iterations here, fringe vertex, that's a question. What is a fringe vertex? Oh, it's just a word I made up. The fringe would be, so a fringe vertex is, fringe vertex would be an unexplored vertex connected to a already explored vertex. That would be the definition. And these orange guys here are fringe vertices. Just to say, the fringe vertices are the eligible vertices. I can choose in the random search one of these fringe vertices. I cannot pull anywhere to some unconnected vertex. So the fringe is just the border of the, if you think about a map, right? You're exploring some unknown territory and you know the map, so that it's all black, a new continent, it's all black. You start at some point, you keep exploring and drawing the map, and the fringe are the points at the fringe, at the border, which you're going to explore next. You cannot jump into the black part of the territory. And then you take a random fringe vertex and keep expanding. To see that the point is maybe I'm summarizing it here. If you do this, we can implement all the graph searches in order of n plus m, so in linear time. And that's the main result here, and that's very good, because order of n plus m is linear time is the least you could do. Right, just for reading the graph, you have to touch all n vertices, you have to touch all m edges. So you just for reading it, you will spend all of n plus m time, and we can explore it by BFS, DFS, or random search. So this holds also for random search in linear time too. Basically, this happens because you touch every vertex exactly once, remember the vertices which were visited and were non-visited, and you touch every edge exactly once. And we have constant time operations for all the rest, right? For visiting the neighbors by using adjacency lists, and for putting vertices into a queue or into a stack. Okay, that would be the basic argument. Okay. I think, is that okay? At the moment. Then let's see, I wanted to show you this a bit more concretely yet. So how do I do that? It's like this possibly. So we stop this part and then we go over here and look at our look at our screen again. So what I have here is it's a Jupyter notebook with code that implements all that stuff we have seen. And I wanted to show you a bit more concretely two things basically. It's very simple to implement these graph searches, very, very simple. We can use a very simple adjacency list implementation, actually adjacency vector implementation. And we will see that the concrete implementation is not very distant from what we have seen in the pseudocode. You can see that notebook and download it at this URL over here. And maybe I can throw this into the chat. I'll put it on the page later too, so that you won't miss that. That's a notebook viewer. So what you see here is an executable notebook of Julia code. It doesn't matter. Julia code is very, very high level, very simple. So let's start this. I'm just getting in some libraries. What I'm doing here is I'm creating a simple geometric called geometric random graph. This is just a bunch of points distributed in the plane randomly. And we connect two points if they have if they're below a certain minimum distance. So what I'm doing here is, well, that code doesn't matter too much. I'm creating such a geograph randomly. So here's the function with geometric graph, make some random coordinates, define an adjacency list. Here you can see this is a vector, which is by the brackets here of a vector. It's an empty vector of vectors. And then I keep pushing to these vectors. This actually constructs a graph in an adjacency vector representation. Here are some helper functions. So we have this, okay. And now here's a little drawing function, just as we can see how that graph looks like. So this is our graph, right? This is a geometric random graph. You can see the black dots are vertices distributed randomly on the plane. And the gray lines are the edges. And so I draw on a graph here with, what was that? I don't know, here, 300 vertices in a unit square from 0, 0 to 1, 1, right? And two vertices are connected if their distance, their Euclidean distance in the plane is less than 0.1. That would be the graph, okay? And now we look at the breadth first search. Here's the implementation. So what does the breadth first search do? We have a queue of vertices, which I'm using an array. So this is the array notation. At the beginning, the array just contains the starting vertex. I maintain two additional vectors here. One is discovered. So just to know if a vertex has been discovered already or not. This is initially is false for all of them. So the falses gn means an array of n Boolean values, everything false. And I set visited for the starting vertex true. And then maintain also the distance here. That's an add-on just to plotting it later on. And I main the exploration order pi. That doesn't matter. This one here, the exploration order pi and the distance was not part of our algorithms. That's just additional stuff I want. And then you see, while the length of the queue is more than 0, so there's a vertex in the queue, make pop first. So you take the first vertex out of the queue, push it into the order, and go over all the neighbors. So for every neighbor W in the neighbors of the vertex V, if it has not been discovered, push it into the queue. So the operations here I'm using in Julia, this is a push into a queue, and this pop first is a pop from a queue. It removes at the other end. Push and pop always works at the end of the vector. Pop first and push first works at the beginning of the vector. So to have a queue, I make pushes, and pop firsts. If I push a vector, I mark it as discovered, and I also update the distance. And at the end, I will be getting here the distance, so the order of the vertices and the distance. Okay. Does it make sense? It's really very close to a high level code. It has a bit of administrative code, but that's basically what happens. Very simple to implement. You can download this notebook. Oh, is it not defined? What's that? Okay, I called it discovered. You can download this notebook and execute it. So we do that. nothing happens. I have these two variables. Now we can have a look at it. So there's a tiny animation which shows how that's working. Let's run that. This will take a few seconds, and then you can see what happens in a breathless search. Frames. And there's a breathless search, okay. So we're starting here on the upper left, and then it goes layer by layer. It starts again layer by layer. Every layer is drawn in a different color, and you can see how it walks over the graph from the upper left to the lower right, and then it stops. Our seed vertex is here. So the, this brownish color is the first one, the second layer it gets lighter and lighter and lighter and lighter brown. There's a fringe or a layer of white vertices, and then come the green colors and so on. That's what happens in a breathless search. Okay. So you can see the different layers in color coding, and you see how it explores the graph basically radially from inside out, right? You have a seed vertex and you go like an onion. You go from inside out and explore the vertex, increasing distance. Okay. That's the effect of a cube. For the random search, we will maintain it also in a queue. So the way I implemented random search was maintaining a fringe. So what I call the fringe in the slides is this queue here. So you have the explored vertices. Initially only S, it has been explored and it has been discovered here. And then I maintain the fringe. This fringe queue contains the vertices which we have found already, but not processed yet. So we put them as discovered true, and then we go over the queue and take another random vertex. So what I'm doing here is I take a random index in the fringe of unexplored vertices. I'm just swapping that index with the end and then pop it from the end. So I'm taking a random vertex out of that queue. I'm pushing it into the exploration order, and then I'm going over all the neighbors. And if the neighbor has not been discovered, I'm pushing it in the queue, and just remember that it has been discovered. That was what this algorithm does. So for an efficient implementation here, you have to maintain the fringe and repeatedly remove a random vertex from the fringe if you want a random exploration. Now let's have a look at this. How does it work? So a few seconds here to see that there are no distances, there are no layers in this in the random search. So you just see the explored vertices. When they're done, so the frames are ready, creating the movie, and there it is. Okay. So you can see the seed vertex is somewhere down there. And the random search, well, proceeds kind of randomly. The seed vertex, I think, is down here, right? It explores the fringe, so it has to go outside from inside outside, but does that in an unsystematic manner. You see some black vertices down here, for example. This black vertex remains unprocessed until late in the exploration. So it certainly goes not by distance, but it expands. The fringe vertices selects the fringe vertices randomly. So it's kind of an unordered search, but it also explores the whole connector component of our starting vertex here. Now, depth first search, finally. Let's run this already. So how does it work? The funny part is, if you look at the code for the depth first search, maybe I'll just take it and put it over here for a second. And compare it to the breadth first search. Okay. You will see that the code is exactly the same. I mean, in the breadth first search, I maintain the distance, which is not part here in the depth first search, but the rest is exactly the same. Discovered vertices, the queue, the length of the queue, you go, you pop an element and so on and so forth. And then you process the neighbors, put it, if it's not discovered, put it in the queue and proceed. What's the difference? The only difference is here. While in BFS, you do a pop first, you move from the other end of the queue, here you do only a pop. So you move at the same end where you push the vertices into, you remove it again. That's all the difference there is in this part. And what happens then, let's look at the depth search. There it is in progress. It's interesting to wait for the cycle to finish. Boom, now it starts again. And you can see how it goes into depth, right? It explores down, deep down the vertices, and then comes up again and explores down again and comes up again. So in the first parts of this search, you can see how it explores this graph. So at the end, all three are very simple to implement. All three have linear time, and all three explore the connected components the connected component of the seed vertex. So they have the same effect in terms of exploration, but they have very different effects in terms of the order of the processed vertices. Well, okay. Is that okay? The animation and the implementation we had. Any questions on that? Don't see anyone at the moment. Seems okay. So no questions here, everything okay. Thank you. And how it seems it's okay. So that's more or less what I wanted to say for today. So I posted the link already. You can download the notebook. You can install Julia and the iJulia packages. Oh, let me show this maybe. Can I do this here? Very, very simple, okay. Usually to do something like that, you have to install Julia. So you just go, okay, let me go over that. If you want to play with that, you go to Julia language, right, okay. And then the Julia language is over there. There's a big download button. You just download Julia. Okay, there's Windows, Mac OS, Linux binaries, source code if you want to do that. And then if you have Julia installed, you can take an IDE or a command line. I'm using command line here. So it's simpler. Let me make this a little bit larger here. Okay, something like that. Then you're starting Julia, and what you do is just you say using iJulia. That's a package. If you don't have it, you have to install it. So if I put here the right bracket, you can go to the package manager, and you would make add iJulia. Now in my case, I have iJulia already, so that shouldn't be a problem. But okay, it's just updating anyway the list of all the packages, da da da. Okay, resolving package versions. And in my case, it should say that's there already. Okay, it's done. I take backspace to get out of the package manager, and I'm saying using iJulia. Okay, using iJulia. Okay. And then I say notebook. And the notebook will open in my browser. If you see that, right, a new browser with Julia, so that's not so interesting. So I have a home here already, and here you can create them new Julia notebooks if you want, and you can take from the notebook viewer. Here you have on the this was some time that I didn't view as code. No, sorry, it's over there. The big button here. You can download that, right? Graph search, save file, so on. And then you can go to your home and put it into the directory where I started the notebook viewer, and you can open the graph search, and then you can see the code, and then you can run the code also, right? Just click on run over there and it can run it. So you can run the code, you can play around, you can see if it makes sense to you and play with. You can create larger graphs here. Just put 300, make it 1000 or something like that. See how it works. You can import other graphs if you want, just to understand the graph searches. Okay. Yeah, so, okay, that was a long lecture, actually, so it took all the time. Yeah, it's good. I'm hungry, I guess you too. So let's stop here. I think, yeah, happily, my PC didn't crash, nothing happened. Recording is still there, so I will stop recording in a few seconds. And yeah, maybe later this day, I put all the stuff online. So the videos for this lecture, the recording for this lecture. If you're still, let me just see one more test. Okay. I will launch a poll. Let me see that. Okay. What is the time complexity of BFS? So you should see a polling and you can respond to one of these three items. Just to see if this works too. Do you see that? Click on something. Yeah, so you can click. You can click. Is it O of N, O of M, or O of N plus M? Oh, everything. Oh, yeah, possibly. Yeah. Are there more? I never did that. Okay. I have to. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm participating here too. Right. Okay. Let me participate as another guy. Just, okay. I do this. Yeah. Select the first question. Then, is it possible that a random search reads the words in exactly the same order as breadth first search? Yes or no? Okay. And is it possible that a breadth first search reads the words in exactly the same order as a depth first search? Depends. And then. Does the time complexity of DFS depend on the order we visit the neighbors of a vertex? Yes or no? Okay. And can we use BFS to find a strongly connected component in a directed graph? Okay, I don't know. And then I say okay, and then I have a response. Okay, but I don't see the results here yet. Okay, I don't know. Zero of 17 voted, but I did vote with my other account, so that cannot be the truth. Well, I don't know. Okay, Guillermo did it too. Yeah, Abel did it too. Attendees are now viewing questions. 0 of 17 voted. Strange. Okay. Well, I'll give it another 30 seconds. So the poll is online for 2:30 now. Another 30 seconds. And then I click on end polling and we see what happens. Well, it's the first time I'm using that. I'm not sure if it works. I was expecting some kind of online update and seeing, I don't know, pie chart, something. Okay, if that not works, I will put that. So that would be the quiz. Can you share the slides with us? Yes, I would. I use the slides kind of interactively. So I erased part of the material, but the final product I will put just online together with the stuff for the class. So later this day, I have a couple of meetings, but later this day, and send us a recording. Yes, too. Yeah. So later this day, there will be lecture 4 clickable and all the videos, BFS, random search, and depth first search. And the recorded video and the quiz, because I think the poll is not working, and also the slides, right? Everything. So I click on end polling just to see what happens. Boom. Nothing. Okay. Mm-hmm. Share results. Oh, there are results. Okay. What's the time complexity of BFS out of n plus m? Yes, that's true. Is it possible that a random search is virtually exactly the same as a breadth first search? Yes, that's true. It's possible. Unlikely if you do it randomly, but it can do it. Yeah. And depth first search, same. Unlikely, but can happen. Does the time complexity of DFS depend on the order we visit the neighbors of vertex? No, it doesn't. You touch every vertex and every edge once, and okay, the order will be slightly different, but the time complexity continues so Lorenzi failed to send a pool here. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. You have to play a bit with the pollings. I closed it, right? I can open it and then I close it and then you probably cannot send anymore. And can you use BFS to find a strongly connected component in Director Graph? Oh, the answer is a bit more complex, but the superficial answer would be no, it's not so easy. We'll see that in one of the next lectures, how to search strongly connected components. So to really find strongly connected components, we have to work hard. Okay. So yeah, that did work somehow. Well, okay, a poll at the end of already long lecture. So thanks for attending. Give me feedback on any stuff. As I said, material will appear online later this day. Give me feedback on anything, what you did like, what you didn't like, what's good, what's bad, what could be done better. If you're okay with the rhythm and the stuff. And if all goes well and everybody agrees, we will have the next lecture on Thursday, 10:30, same time, same place. I will send an invitation. Okay? Everything okay? Thanks for lecture, good feedback. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you for the lecture. All good. Thanks. Okay. Well, seems most of you thought it's okay. Yeah. So thank you. And I see you on Thursday. So I stop recording.